Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to all our listeners. This is the Business Day Spotlight, your destination for African business made simple. My name is Mdiwa Gabaza, and for today, we talk once again about what's going on in and around the world of vaccinations, but looking at African economies in, you know, in particular. We've had a couple of shows looking at South Africa's response, but for today, we're also trying to contrast that with what's going on in the rest of Africa. We've sort of hinted on it, you know, previously, looking at what's going on in places like, you know, Botswana, what's going on in Namibia, and East Africa, etc. But to sort of give us a more holistic approach for today, we are joined by Dr. Ernest Dako, who is a founding partner with the Broadreach Group, and is going to be giving us and sharing his insights around this important issue that we're going to be dealing with, at least for the foreseeable future. Dr. Dako, greetings to you.
Greetings, Mdiwa, and thank you for having me on your podcast.
A good place for us to start, the Broadreach Group and your interest when it comes to African economies, when it comes to public health, when it comes to vaccinations.
Well, the Broadreach Group really has been dedicated in to trying to really balance the scales when it comes to the mismatch between the big burdens of disease we have on the African continent and our ability to address them. And we feel that traditional methods of closing these gaps that we have are not going to work because they're just too profound. You know, we have sort of like, I think something like 94% less doctors than any of the other leading economies, but yet we have bigger burdens of disease, you know. So with that sort of being the basic landscape we have to deal with, we need to figure out how to be creative, how to be agile, and still basically providing superior healthcare with radically less resources. So we've been dedicated to trying to solve that problem, and we feel very strongly that the X factor that will allow us to do this is technology. So we've really specialized in figuring out how to use technology innovatively to give us an advantage over what's otherwise, I think, a quite daunting situation to deal with.
And when it comes to all of that, what do you make before we get into specific regions and countries, just as a whole, Africa's response to COVID-19 before we get into vaccines?
I think overall Africa's response, I'd have to, you know, rate it as quite good. You know, I think for the most part, with exception of a few countries who have basically denied that there's a pandemic, for the most part, countries responded very well. They took appropriate initial public health measures, like the hygiene measures, hand washing, wearing masks, to the extent possible, the social distancing. And I think for the most part, countries have tried to respond really well. We saw overall, I think, what happened, I think, in the first wave was that it was not as bad as people thought. And I think it made people relax a bit too much. And therefore, we saw a much more devastating second wave. And I think now, as we sit here, the issue is, are we going to have a third wave, in particular, for example, in places like here in South Africa, where we're about to go into winter? Are we going to have a third wave or not? And now with vaccines in play, how are we going to manage both the issue of managing any new waves that come from a medical management and public health management point of view, but how are we going to also roll out the vaccine programs as aggressively as possible? And as you know, there have been challenges on both of those fronts.
And when it comes to, I guess, switching over to now the vaccine, right, a lot of countries have had their targets. I think in South Africa, we had set a 67, you know, sort of 70%-ish, two-thirds type of target around vaccinations. But at the moment, the current rate of vaccination is quite low. And I understand that you've done some, you know, some thorough calculations just around what it would actually take to achieve these goals in South Africa, but more importantly, for the continent as a whole. Can you guys give us a a flavor of how those numbers are and where we actually stand.
Yeah, so I'll start with the African continent. You know, we're looking at vaccinating roughly 780 million people across the African continent. And so if you assume, let's say you give yourself 12 months to accomplish that, that would be 3.5 million single dose vaccinations you have to do per day, meaning that people just need one dose. So that would be like the AstraZeneca vaccine or the J&J vaccine that was single dose. So, and if you carry that calculation forward, 3.5 million doses a day would be about 437,000 doses an hour. You know, so that's quite daunting. And then if you come down, and if we double click down onto South Africa, and we're trying to vaccinate about 40 million people, and we say over a 12-month period, that would be about 182,000 people per day for single dose, or 364,000 if it's a double dose, and that would be about 45,000 vaccinations per hour that we're supposed to be accomplishing to stay on track. And this is also assuming sort of no new variants, no big interruptions. And as we've already seen, you know, the initial intention to start with AstraZeneca got interrupted. And then we moved to J&J, and then likewise that got interrupted, you know. So it's not easy to get this done. And so meaning from a mathematics perspective, we're already behind just regardless, just based on the issues we've run into so far. However, that said, knowing what needs to be accomplished in the form of these numbers means we can be very planful about it and make sure that we have the capacities in place to run our engine at the level required to get this done. And what I always say is even an interruption is an opportunity for us to plan better, to get our house in order, to get all the building blocks in place so that we can then move at lightning speed when we're able to move.
How much of our inability to reach the targets that have been set, how much of that is teething problems? Because this is a massive type of rollout for any country around the world, and you know, different economies have been grappling with this issue. So how much of that is teething problems, and that we will see a ramping up over time, versus guys, the expectations that were set are just simply unrealistic?
So I would frame it maybe slightly differently, right? Because we're saying it's teething problem, then yes, to some extent, I'd say maybe the smaller extent, we are dealing with teething problems. But remember, on the African continent, we've had malaria for hundreds of years. We've not addressed it. We've had HIV for like 30, 40 years. We've not addressed that. We don't have everybody who has HIV on HIV treatment. And we've had like 30, 40 years to address that. We've not addressed, you know, diabetes. We've not addressed hypertension. So the issue I point out is, if we've not addressed all these other diseases effectively and where we're completely in control of managing them across our populations, why do we think that we're going to manage COVID in like 1 year? You know, in particular, we're talking about an airborne pathogen that, you know, it's in the air, you can breathe it in, highly infectious, meaning large numbers can be infected quickly. If our health systems and our models and our approaches have failed to date for every other thing, why did we think that somehow this is the one we're going to all of a sudden be able to address in 6 months or 1 year, right? So yes, teething problems in part, because as you point out, it is a massive undertaking based on the numbers I've just sort of expressed as well. However, we're talking about innate weaknesses, we're a legacy of innate weaknesses that this COVID is finding us with, you know what I mean? And we have to address some of these legacy and innate issues as well as the teething problems in order to successfully address this. So that's why I always say we need to be realistic. As far as I'm concerned, everything is happening exactly as we should have expected. There's nothing new here in terms of where we've stalled, our slowness or inability, because that's been the case with every other thing we've tried to do on this continent. You know, so I think we shouldn't be acting surprised, but instead I feel COVID is an opportunity for us to say, okay, now we need to really improve our overall health systems so that they're more resilient against current shocks that we already have, because I mentioned all of the things we need to address right now that we're not addressing, and then future COVIDs and COVID itself, right? Because who said COVID is going to be the last pandemic that comes our way? So this is, I think, a real opportunity, a watershed moment for us to do the reckoning and the thinking about, therefore, what do we really need to be doing right?
You know, as you're talking, one of the things that I'm thinking about is, you know, when it comes to this reality versus the expectation, is the actual cost of the vaccine. Because so far, the little that I've seen around the different African countries, in broad terms, it seems as if a lot of African countries are doing vaccinations for free, in line with other parts of the world as well, right? So from an economic standpoint, is that, you know, realistically speaking, because it seems like right now we're managing our expectations in this conversation, right? So realistically speaking, can African countries or the African economy afford to inoculate this almost a billion population, you know, using state resources or for free? Or are we going to see, you know, maybe second or third order consequences down the line, you know, whether it's increased taxes or, you know, money being pinched from other parts, you know? Yeah,
I think we have to look at that, answer that question from a short-term, medium-term, and long-term perspective, right? I think in the immediate term, no, Africa cannot afford to pay for these doses. And rightfully, we're seeing a constellation of different partners and donors coming together through mechanisms like CEPI and COVAX to try and figure out how we bridge that financial divide to procure the doses, right? But remember, we also need to buy all the syringes. We need to buy all the, you know, the supplies that go with the vaccination program, right? We need to pay for staff, and, you know, so there's a lot of other costs that still needs to be borne. And I think countries are bearing those costs to varying degrees. So I think in the immediate term, we do need that, this kind of global support and really a very much donation focused model. In the medium and long term, however, the reality is Africa is not poor, right? I know we have fed ourselves this narrative that we are poor for as long as I've been alive, you know, and I'm 51 years old. But we've always told ourselves that we're poor, but we're not actually poor. We're arguably the wealthiest continent on the planet, right? So if we start to figure out how to use our resources more appropriately, how to negotiate things for ourselves in a manner that is advantageous to the continent, I believe we actually do have the resources to do this. The problem right now, for example, when you think about negotiating prices, you have 53 different countries now going out to each try and negotiate their own prices. So you have a country with 1.5 million people going and trying to negotiate with suppliers, and then another country with, you know, 120 million, 130 million people, like Nigeria, for example, going and negotiating as well. Why can't we do a combined bargaining for the continent, for example, to get the best price because we can offer the biggest volume, for example? And then on top of that, and on the long term, then we need to then also look at manufacturing and supporting our own markets at, again, prices that can be affordable. The big caution and caveat I give about manufacturing is that in the short term, if you set up your own manufacturing, it might be more expensive in the short term than buying externally, because externally, they've already developed the economies of scale and therefore can offer these drugs at a lowest price. If you set up, you have to invest billions in building the infrastructure in order to then manufacture the drugs. In the short term, it might be more expensive. But if we all know why we're doing this, for, as a continent, and we say we are going to do this for our market, then we can acceptably bear the high cost initially until the economies of scale grow enough for the prices then to become much lower. And then we can also compete globally as well. So in my estimate, in the medium and long term, we do have the resources, but immediately we need the help.
Doctor, the other thing, you know, on that, because you've really brought in what I think is a crucial point when you started talking about the 53 countries, and that there's this, can I call it a decentralized approach to negotiating prices, supplies, and all of this stuff with the various manufacturers. And especially if we're going to say that globalization hasn't really stopped because of COVID, then it means as a continent, we're effectively competing against regions that have sort of come together, because the United States is essentially a group of 50 or so, you know, different states, you know, or countries that have come together, and the EU, you know, sort of the same structure, obviously working, you know, on different models, but there is that coming together. So against that background, what do you make of the Africa Continental Free Trade Agreement, which was meant to have really been now underway in the last year? I'm not sure whether we can say COVID-19 has helped or detracted from it, because at least we've seen some efforts from the AU to try and have, you know, some of these more centralized planning approaches.
In a way, I think this is where, again, when I talk about using COVID to our advantage, I'm not for any second, minimizing the devastation it's caused. However, in our response, like I said, it gives us a huge opportunity and huge sort of focusing ability to finally fulfill some of these covenants that we've spoken about, but never really actualized. So the Africa Continent-Wide Free Trade Agreement is one of them. But I think, as you're already seeing, the AU, especially via the efforts of the Africa CDC, I think have made much greater strides towards these objectives because of COVID than if we did not have COVID, right? So for example, if you look at right now how the Africa CDC and AU are coalescing, the response across countries, coordinating with COVAX, coordinating with CEPI. In essence, I'm seeing the building blocks coming together where for the first time, we are beginning to have a meaningful continent-wide approach to this through efforts of entities like the Africa CDC compared to ever before. So in my 20 years of doing this, I've never seen our regional bodies responding as effectively or trying to respond as effectively as they are now. I think the main thing is we need to support this and we need to enhance it even further. And we need to basically take some of these things all the way. So for example, if now we're realizing we really need to put more bones and flesh on the free trade agreement to make it practical and real, then this is the time to do it. What are we waiting for? Right. And I think, unfortunately, we've tended to be crisis prompted. We wait until, the fire is at its peak. And then we say, now we need to mobilize resources. Now we need to go and create policies. That's the wrong time to do it. So as you saw, why have US and Europe responded more effectively? Because they've had their frameworks in place for decades. Right. So here comes COVID, but it's landing on a very organized and hardened framework where the interactions have been worked out, the modalities have been worked out so they can respond more quickly, as we're seeing. And they have also, as you said, been able to exercise their combined power, you know, to get what they want. In our case, we're early days in doing that, but I think we can use these efforts, in particular by supporting what the Africa CDC is trying to do at the moment, to really springboard ourselves, forward into a position where, in essence, we're tapping into the power and strength of the collective a lot more than we've ever done.
You know, the ironic thing about everything we're talking about right now, I've had conversations with people, over the last year, saying that, you know, some of the issues that Africa has been slammed down about when it comes to the international community, such as, you know, dictatorships and, you know, not really adhering to human rights in certain regions, that those were some of the factors that worked well in terms of mitigating the spread of COVID-19 in Africa, right? Because it meant that if a country said to its people, you are staying home, People stayed home. You are staying home. People stayed home, right? People stayed home. They put armies on the streets. They really went into proper lockdowns, right? But unfortunately, that you know, that type of approach, and especially in the little silos of each country, sort of means the flip side is that now, despite the fact that we have seen. I think we can all agree that, you know, the initial response to COVID-19 was a disaster in the West, right? But now there are decades of, you know, systems being in place help them when it comes to vaccinations, which is where it's our systems are now sort of falling flat on their faces.
Well, so that's I think the one really big debate, and it will evoke a lot of emotion on both sides of whether, you know, autocracy, you know, it helps you to respond in these situations better than, for example, true democracy, where you're trying to go and get everyone's opinion and everyone to agree before you move. I do believe, I think it's accepted as a globally, by the way, it's accepted that in emergency circumstances, the best response is much more of a command and control model. You know, you can't have too many, you know, generals, you know, in charge when you're trying to respond to a life and death emergency that is at your doorstep today, right? You need one source, you know, quickly taking control, telling people what to do, giving clear direction, you know, giving clear, you know, instructions on what people to do. And so emergency management by definition does require a certain degree of autocracy, right, for it to respond effectively and save the most lives. That said, I think to me the biggest issue we've had in Africa is even when we responded appropriately, for example, we're telling people stay home, which is the appropriate thing. In our case, we have so much poverty, we have so much unemployment, right? We have so much lack of electricity. We have actually so much lack of proper housing. So when you tell someone to stay home, what does that actually mean when you live in a cardboard shack, right? So we have this, although you respond properly, the practical ability for the population to fulfill this is across a big, wide bell curve, right? We have some of the wealthiest people in the world in Africa, and we have some of the poorest people in the world in Africa. The wealthy, it's fine. They can bunker in and have all the resources they need. The very poorest person who actually doesn't have a home is homeless. Next level up, maybe I live in a shack, right? I don't have food, I don't have water to do that hand washing you're saying, I don't have soap to actually do the hand washing. So I think what we have is some issues that are really fundamental where even if you try to do the right thing, you don't get the results you want. And therefore, I think to me, COVID actually for the first time really has practically shown people how healthcare is tied to every other sector. It's tied to employment, it's tied to housing, it's tied to food security, right? So I think for the first time we acknowledge that, and I'm hoping therefore going forward, we will approach healthcare differently. Healthcare is not just the ambit of the Ministry of Health. Healthcare is the ambit of whole of government. And that's why we need a whole government response. And then what you need is data. So for example, if I know these areas have no water and no proper housing, then those become prioritized to get those things because you know that actually protects you the most from the epidemic. Because as you know, this epidemic doesn't stay in one place. It you know, as like we saw with the new variant, now the new variant has moved around the world. It didn't just stay in South Africa, for example. So for us, it's a priority to fix these things at a fundamental level. So meaning that a health intervention is actually offering, bringing water to those people, hygiene supplies, providing food, and providing energy so that they can actually, for example, refrigerate their food so they don't have to go out for food every day, et cetera. So it means we need this truly a combined response if we're going to do this. And that's a very, very different way than we've operated so far.
As we end off the discussion, could you maybe give us your thoughts, because you had sort of outlined issues and places where things could be made better. You've already highlighted the fact that all of this could be an opportunity for African countries to come together, you know, realize the dream of the AU, whether we're going to call it the coming together of the AU, the Africa Free Trade Continental Agreement, but it does need to be that coming together. In closing, your thoughts just around some positives throughout this period? And, firstly, with the responses and the vaccinations, have there been regions, that have actually done things well, that you can actually commend?
So I think we're definitely seeing, certain best countries that have moved really fast, and in terms of implementing their vaccine program successfully. Unfortunately, what we've seen is those countries tended to be ones that had the biggest resources. They got in there, they negotiated and locked in supplies early, and they have massive delivery infrastructure in place basically to deliver. In my estimate, when I look at the African continent in particular, we have some North African countries that I think are doing quite well. I think South Africa has been trying to do well, but has been hampered by quite a few things also that have been out of the country's control. And so I do believe our response from the point of view of the practical planning, the communication, the procurement, the use of data and electronic systems. I think South Africa is actually quite exemplary in that regard, despite the fact that we've run into some roadblocks based on issues that have are being investigated about the vaccine, which I don't believe are actually significant enough issues to be stopping the program, to be honest. But that said, we do have to let this play out from the point of view of the experts making the right decisions to ensure that we're moving forward safely. So from my perspective, I think in Africa at the moment, we're still suffering with the issue of, I'd say, figuring out the day-to-day logistics, even with the vaccines we have procured, figuring out how to roll them out effectively enough and quickly enough before they expire, right? And I think every country at the moment is trying to struggle and grapple with those issues. And I think we know how to do this. I've made myself available for free to anybody who wants to ask how to do this in terms of the micro detail that you need to have planned for in order to roll out effectively. So it can be done. And I believe countries will be able to do this. But it is really about appreciating and understanding the level of planning you need to do and the level of preparation you need to do. And it can be done. So for me, the positive thing at the moment is that if we keep the hygiene measures, keep the social distancing measures in place to keep the disease as low as possible, maximize the time we have to prepare, we can save lives and get on top of this epidemic while preserving our economies. The delays in the vaccination program are to be expected, and therefore that's why we should not let up on all the other measures of COVID control that we need to be holding. We just need to hold them a while longer so that we can get our house in order. And then we can also add the vaccination as an additional layer of protection to save our populations. So to me, the story isn't doom and gloom. It's one of opportunity. It's the opportunity to do things right. And we can do that. There's nothing stopping us from doing that, I believe, at this point.
So that's been it in our discussion with Dr. Ernest Darko, who is a founding partner of Broadreach Group, joining us from Cape Town, giving us some insight into what's going on in and around Africa's economies when it comes to first the COVID-19 response, but more importantly, just the practicalities around rolling out the vaccine. He was giving us his calculations just around what it would actually take to inoculate the African population, at least to the extent that African leaders had sort of set out when vaccine rollouts first began. One of the things that he's saying is the fact that there have been a number of diseases that have affected Africa over the years and are still yet to be effectively addressed, things such as HIV, malaria, and hypertension. And he's saying, why do we think that, this is the one place where we'll be able to get all our ducks in a row and do everything in a year? Some of the roadblocks that we're seeing, some of the, slowdowns in the pace of rollout are exactly you know, what we should be expecting, because there's a lot of infrastructure and systems that still need to be put in place for African countries and Africa as a whole to have an effective response to something like COVID-19. An advantage that we've seen sort of playing out with the way that things are going in the European Union, for example, or the United States. So that's been it. Dr. Ernest Dalkor, thank you so much for being with us.
Mudiyo, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
This is Mudiyo's Take.
A very fascinating discussion there with Dr. Dalkor, and I really enjoyed the fact that he is, you know, honing in on some of the structural issues, because as we were both talking, we agreed that some of the issues that have plagued the African continent, you know, sort of helped us with the response, the initial response of getting people to stay home. But everything else that happens after that, you know, such as getting vaccines in at lower prices for each country, making sure that as African countries we band together so that we have greater bargaining power, that, you know, those structures hadn't really been in place, though we've seen some good progress coming in from the African Union together with the African CDC just around that. So it really does seem like this is a good opportunity, as the doctor is saying, about bringing African, you know, leaders together, and especially African countries and the different regions together, sort of under one banner, to sort of start, you know, competing as a regional bloc as opposed to different countries. Because the truth of the matter is, as a continent, if we're engaging with countries like the US, where you've got a group of, you know, essentially 50 or so countries or states, and then versus the EU, where you have a similar coming together of countries, perhaps under different structures, right? Then it sort of makes sense, because the other big, you know, regional and economic powers that are out there have similar populations, because at the end of the day, it's about pulling in the different populations. When you look at Africa, as for example, the African continent has a much bigger population than the whole of the United States. And I think the same can be said about Europe. And this is what makes countries like China and India very powerful, because they each have 1 billion+ people, right? So when they're sitting at the negotiating table, they're speaking not on behalf of maybe some small province in the middle of the Sahara Desert somewhere. They are literally talking about 1 billion people. And this is not to say that, you know, some small group of people in the Sahara Desert doesn't matter. But when you're trying to get the best prices, the best supplies, you know, sign the best deals for your people, you need to have that coalescing, that coming together of people. So really hope that, as the doctor says, that this will be a catalyst that helps African countries to come together, especially if we're going to realize the true benefits of the Africa Free Trade Continental Agreement, right? And all of this, its benefits, right? More intertrade, more policies, more regional policies that are actually enforced, that are centrally planned, but actually enforced in the different countries. I mean, we don't have to have like one currency, you know, like the euro. It would be nice, you know, I think, but a lot would have to go into that. But before any of that even happens, you know, a baby needs to, you know, crawl before they walk. And, you know, for now, we just need to learn as Africans to work together so that the African economy, as opposed to the economies, are able to be driven forward. So that's been it for this edition of the Business Day Spotlight. Remember that you can find our latest podcasts on Business Live, that is under the podcast Business Day Spotlight tab on Twitter, with hashtag BD Spotlight. And remember that you can find and review and subscribe for free on iono.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, wherever you choose to get your pods casted. Thank you to our amazing team. Our producer is Paige Muller. I've been Mudiwa Gavaza of the Business Day and Financial Mail, and this has been another edition of the Business Day Spotlight, which is a multimedia live production. So for myself and the rest of the team, it is good evening, good afternoon, and good morning.